The scripture reading will be coming from the book of Ephesians, Ephesians chapter 4, verses 31 and 32. Ephesians chapter 4, verses 31 and 32, and it will be read from the New King James Version. Let all bitterness, wrath, anger, clamor, and evil speaking be put away from you with all malice. And be kind to one another, tender-hearted, forgiving one another, even as God in Christ forgave.
Good evening. There was a saying I ran across not too long ago. It stated that anger ruins joy, joy steals the goodness of my mind, forces my mouth to say terrible things. Overcoming anger brings peace of mind, leads to a mind without regrets. If I overcome anger, if I overcome anger, I will be delighted and loved by everyone. I was looking this up. I actually presented this material about just over a year ago down in a meeting that we had in Waco. And I had a brother ask me that, you know, might be a good idea to present it here as well. So some of you have heard some of this information about a year ago. It will still be good to listen as well. What I want to talk about tonight is dealing with anger. But as in Ephesians 4, 31, 32 tells us that, look at the likenesses we have here. Let all bitterness, wrath, anger, clamor, and evil speaking be put away from you. And I'm going to talk a little bit, mostly about anger, but it's going to touch on a lot of these things as well. Now, there's a Greek word of pikros, and it talks about bitterness or anger, and it means sharp and piercing. And again, I guess when you think about with bitterness, when you bite into something that's real sour or bitter, you know, what's your first reaction? It's not good. You're not smiling about that. You're usually turning away from it as well. And John MacArthur describes it as a smoldering resentment, a brooding, grudge-filled attitude. It's a spirit of irritability that keeps a person in perpetual animosity, making him sour and venomous. Another commentary says bitterness also, or an anger, is settled hostility that poisons the whole inner man. Now we think about the things that kind of make us angry, make us bitter, maybe can cause us to wrath. What are those things? In each one of us, it probably differs a little bit. People get angry at the smallest things anymore. If you're driving, you know, and someone cuts you off or you cut them off, whatever it may be, you can actually be shot for that today. People get so angry that they'll take their frustrations out and actually attempt to kill you over the smallest things. And many times it starts with these just small angry feelings that we have over a specific offense. Now, bitterness involves these angry feelings that we hang on to. You know, and bitterness usually, too, is talking about that anger that we just keep. We don't let go. We hold on to it. And it could be years down the road. Maybe we thought someone did something to us. But you know what? We just hang on to that. I'm never going to let that go. I'm never going to forgive them. And remember, and I'll kind of reiterate this because I think we don't really view or utilize forgiveness as we truly should. I know I talked about it here not too long ago, but sometimes we hold on to things and we're not truly forgiveness. I know I spoke with several people about this and there's kind of some different, outlooks upon it. But I truly believe that we don't really understand forgiveness as we should. But I'm not going to talk about forgiveness anymore tonight. But again, this anger that we have, this resentment, and it continues to carry on with us. Now, if we think about some of these things in anger, that it resurfaces when we're around the person who has offended us. And what do we tend to do? So we avoid them, right? And then we're around them, the slightest little thing of provocation can set us off. Can kind of us keep thinking about whatever that thing was that happened as well. Sometimes we become jaded about everything that person does. And we assume the worst. We want to assume just the worst thing then with that and attach that worst motive to everything that they do. So from now on, whatever that person says, whatever that person does, all we think about is something besides whatever it is they're doing. They're probably doing even something for us, right? Well, even when efforts are made to reconcile, we refuse to talk or impose impossible conditions upon that person as well. We want to set these standards then, that they have to meet this now just for me to be able to talk to them. Well, that's not a Christian attitude. And the other problem is with anger, with bitterness, with wrath, is the fact that it works like a long-acting poison, killing us from the inside. What are we getting from it, I guess, is a question to ask as well. What are we gaining from this anger that we have? Are we gaining a brother or a sister? Are we feeling like we maybe won over something upon them? What I want us to do is just briefly tonight consider ourselves and us dealing with anger, with bitterness, with wrath. And how do we react to things? How do we react to our coworkers when they do something? How do we react to our family? What about our brothers and sisters in Christ? Where do we stand today as Christians? Are you angered with a fellow brother or sister here? Is there something that you're holding on to and you can't let go? And again, I'll reiterate this at the end. If that's the case, that's on you. Proverbs 29, verse 11 says, "A fool always loses his temper, but a wise man holds it back." I think every one of us, maybe at some point or another, maybe more often than we would like, or we'd like to admit, that we've lost our temper. Maybe we've been short. Maybe we're tired. We've had a bad day. I remember one time I was in the hospital and got into an argument with the doctor. Well, I was sitting in the hospital and wasn't feeling well. My heart was actually out of rhythm. And he was just kind of, I felt just pushing me aside, not really caring, telling me, I think at one point he said, "Well, this is normal." I was 20, I don't know, 22, 23. Like, this is not normal. And then I even remember jumping back and said, "Well, is your heart out of rhythm? Are you sitting here in this bed?" "No." Well, he started yelling, and it just both of us kind of escalated. The head of the floor came up one day, later that day, and apologized. Said, "Well, he just had a long day." So see, it's just these things that can set us off, and we have to be careful. Just like Proverbs 29:11 tells us, a fool always loses his temper, but a wise man holds it back. There's an article back from, and I didn't have the date on this, from Truth Magazine called "Losing Your Temper" from her brother Paul Williams. And he said, "A fool is one who does not have good judgment, who does not profit from experience or discipline. The one who says there is no God is a fool because he is denying the evidence surrounding him. The one who always loses his temper is a fool because repeated experience has taught him nothing." And then he says, "I can think of five reasons why losing my temper makes me a fool." And he lists these five things, and I'm going to have them on the board here. I guess I should point it downwards. Okay. He says, "Many times it causes me to do things of which afterwards I am ashamed. My temper overcomes my good judgment and I act the fool." If you notice, too, the songs were a little bit, compressed tonight, too. And I think it's the version that I'm using on the PowerPoint because this happens just about every time. So bear with me. But he also point number two, he states that losing my temper makes me act from the emotion of anger without thinking. He says, James warns that the anger of man does not achieve the righteousness of God in James 1 and verse 20. "I simply want to strike out and hurt the object of my anger. Thus," he says, "that unrighteousness is the result." Losing my temper demonstrates that I lack self-control and I lose the respect of those who know me. A man without self-control cannot be trusted with responsibility because he may ruin everything in a burst of anger. This is the reason, that an elder must not be quick-tempered, as referenced in Titus 1 in verse 7. Losing my temper causes me to hurt those I love the most. When I become angry, it makes no difference if the person is my wife or my child. I strike out with words or blows. How foolish to hurt these loved ones. And then point number 5, he says, when I lose my temper, I usually succeed in causing the other person to lose his, and we wind up two fools instead of one. Again, I just thought that was an interesting article on anger and losing our temper. Because again, we consider all of the effects that it has, not just on ourselves, but upon others as well. And then the outlook that those have around us. I also want to consider Joseph's battle with bitterness. And I'm going to reference some verses here too. I'm not going to, just don't have the time to read that. But in Genesis 37, we'll get to in just a minute, but many of the bitter people that we might meet usually want to say that or believe that their circumstances justify their attitude and their anger. In other words, they want to say, well, you don't understand. This is what they did to me. This is what's happened to me. This is what they did to my family. This is what they've done to me at work. We always want to kind of justify that our anger, our bitterness, our wrath, whatever it may be, is okay, that I can continue in it. You know, and they'll say, you don't know how bad I've been treated. But God has an answer for that. He would point us to Joseph in the Old Testament here. And if there was ever a man who had a right to be bitter, it would probably be Joseph. Again, if you take the time, I'm not going to read through it tonight, but Genesis 37 records the animosity of Joseph's brothers and their willingness, if you can recall, to sell him into slavery. He ends up in Egypt as a slave, but it doesn't end right there. While in Egypt, he had a number of setbacks. One, when he refused the advances of his master's wife, she accused him of trying to assault her, and Joseph was thrown into prison. He's lied about. He's betrayed. Again. In prison, he helped one of his fellow inmates who later forgot him when he was released. He was betrayed once again. And through God's providential power, Joseph is given the opportunity to interpret the dream of the Pharaoh. And a great famine is averted. Joseph is appointed to a very powerful position. In the preparation for the famine, Joseph is put in charge of distributing all the food that was stored. When strangers come from distant lands to buy this food, then he recognizes them as his own brothers. Now, Joseph here being a powerful man, now a man of stature, having a powerful position, with their very lives in his hands, what would he do? What would you do in that instance? Again, he had been sold into slavery by his brothers. He had so many other things happen. Now he's risen up. He's in a position of power. Well, he recognizes these strangers as his brothers. If you would, look with me in Genesis chapter 45. Genesis 45, beginning in verse 1 here, says, then Joseph could not control himself. Before all those who stood by him, he cried, make everyone go out from me. So no one stayed with him when Joseph made himself known to his brothers. And he wept aloud, so that the Egyptians heard it, and the household of Pharaoh heard it. And Joseph said to his brothers, I am Joseph. Is my father still alive? But his brothers could not answer him, for they were dismayed at his presence. So Joseph said to his brothers, come near to me, please. And they came near. And he said, I'm your brother Joseph, whom you sold into Egypt. And now do not be distressed or angry with yourselves because you sold me here, for God sent me before you to preserve life. For the famine has been in the land these 2 years, and there are yet 5 years in which there will be neither plowing nor harvest. And God sent me before you to preserve for you a remnant on earth, and to keep alive for you many survivors. So it was not you who sent me here, but God. He has made me a father to Pharaoh and lord of all his house and ruler over all the land of Egypt. Hurry and go up to my father and say to him, thus says your son Joseph, God has made me lord of all Egypt. Come down to me, do not tarry. You shall dwell in the land of Goshen, and you shall be near me, you and your children and your children's children, and your flocks, your herds, and all that you have. There I will provide for you. For there are yet 5 years of famine to come, so that you and your household and all you have do not come to poverty. And now your eyes see, and the eyes of my brother Benjamin see, that it is my mouth that speaks to you. You must tell my father of all my honor in Egypt and of all that you have seen. Hurry and bring my father down here. Then he fell upon his brother Benjamin's neck and wept, and Benjamin wept upon his neck. And he kissed all his brothers and wept upon them. After that, his brothers talked with them. How could Joseph treat these guys so good after everything they had done to him? How could he just welcome them into his loving arms? He says he's hugging them, kissing them. He's so happy to see them. How can he treat them so well? There was a Elbert Hubbard, who's an early American writer, and he observed that the final proof of greatness lies in being able to endure contemptuous treatment without resentment. How would we react? How would we behave in these similar circumstances? So what can we learn from Joseph then? Well, we need to understand first that sometimes anger can make us lose perspective. We can completely lose perspective on everything due to our anger. Our anger is going to give us just narrow vision that all we want to do is cause harm to somebody else. Now, not just physical harm, but it could be emotional harm. Unfortunately, with social media today, with Facebook, with Twitter, with MySpace, you know, there's what's called cyberbullying even today, that people are so angry and they want to lash out at others on there. And again, we kind of inflate things in our minds. Going back to what we talked about, we want to justify those things. We always want to justify that what we're doing is right, that my anger is right. It's okay. Don't you remember what they did to me? Don't you understand what they did 10 years ago? However long it may be. We always want to justify it. And we should be challenged, again, by the wounds that Joseph suffered here. Have any of us faced even anything close to the degree of resentment that Joseph had faced? The degree of mistreatment that Joseph had come upon? Yet how angry was he? He wasn't. His faith was tested over a long period of time, a very long period of time in this matter. And after Jacob dies, Joseph's brothers fear that animosity and vengefulness still lie in the heart of Joseph, and that here is the opportunity for Joseph to get even with the evil they had done to him. So if you would, now let's look at Genesis chapter 50. And again, I'm going to start actually in about verse 15, but previously, actually in verse 14, he had buried his father, and he returns to Egypt. So Jacob has died, he's buried him, he's returned to Egypt with his brothers, and they go to bury his father. Now, beginning in verse 15 of Genesis chapter 50 here, it says that when Joseph's brothers saw their father was dead, they said, "It may be that Joseph will hate us and pay us back for all the evil that we did to him." So they sent a message then to Joseph saying, "Your father gave the command before he died. Say to Joseph, please forgive the transgression of your brothers and their sin, because they did evil to you. And now, please forgive the transgression of the servants of the God of your father." Joseph wept when they spoke to him. And his brothers also came and fell down before him and said, "Behold, we are your servants." But Joseph said to them, "Do not fear, for am I in the place of God? As for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good to bring it about that many people should be kept alive as they are today. So do not fear. I will provide for you and your little ones." Thus he comforted them and spoke kindly to them. Again, it's just amazing that we can continue looking at Joseph and his reaction to his brothers. So again, after Jacob dies, now they're afraid. What's he going to do now? This isn't good for us. But no. On the contrary, once again, Joseph again at the end says, "Do not fear, I'm going to provide for you." And he spoke kindly to them. He could have viewed it as an opportunity for revenge. But we need to understand the principles and characteristics of the God that we serve. Joseph understood that it was God's blessing and providence, that those things weren't given to him just to serve his own fleshly desires. They weren't given to him just so he can take vengeance upon his brothers. If you think about the game of tennis. Now, when two argue, like angry tennis players, each one's going to hit the ball harder and harder. It's just going to keep happening. And what happens is they drive each other farther and farther away into that corner. It just keeps hitting it harder and harder. Pretty soon, they're not going to be able to hit the ball back and forth because they're just hitting it out. They're just so angry. You know, Proverbs 17, verse 14 talks about that the beginning of any fight is like a dike with a leak. If the leak is stopped and plugged right away before it gets out of hand, you're going to be able to overcome the water. You want to stop that leak right away. But if a leak grows larger, as sand and earth rot away, soon that water is going to be just gushing out all over the place, sweeping everything away. You're not going to be able to close that leak to stop that water. Therefore, we need to take care of it before it gets too big and before that flood opens up and we can't stop it. Now, we also need to understand something in the fact that anger is not sinful. Jesus, who lived without sin, was angry. And many passages, even in the Bible passages, refer to God's anger and wrath. We look at, in the Old Testament, Numbers, many times, Numbers 11, Numbers 10, Numbers 12, talks about God's anger, God's wrath. So anger in itself is not inherently sinful. But we can learn how we need to... how our anger should be when we look at God's anger, comparing that with our own anger. And I have a chart here, too. It lists a couple things, and what we need to understand is how God's anger and how man's anger differ. With God's anger, it's controlled and with a purpose. With man's, it's uncontrolled, and there's no purpose to it. You know, again, we want that anger. Rage was another word that I thought of before, too, that we could have even added to our list of words here. With God's anger, it's not with hatred, malice, or resentment. But with man, it's exactly that. With God, it's not selfish. With man, it's very selfish. I want to get back at that person. And I'll do anything I can to get back at them. I'm going to show them. I'm going to, you know, give a one-up over them. God's anger was an expression of concern, but man, it's an expression of indignation. Again, that rage, that wrath. That's why we're angry at them. With God's anger, it's to correct or curtail some type of destructive behavior. With man's, just the opposite again. It's to destroy that individual. With God's, it's an expression of care. With man's, we got to get back at him. It's revenge. God's anger is not to break relationships, but, again, man's anger is directed at breaking that relationship, whether it's between those two people that are angry at one another or maybe some others involved in there. You know, many times what will happen is if you're angry at somebody or someone's angry at someone, they'll go to other people. Hey, did you hear what so-and-so did? Did you hear what they said? Yeah, and then they'll just try to spread that around everyone. God's anger was at injustice. Man's was at violations of self. God's was at willful disobedience. Man's is at those who cross me. You know, those who cut me off. Those who maybe said the wrong thing to me. Well, anger, again, I said anger in itself isn't sinful, but it can become sinful when it's allowed to be expressed other than to resolve a problem, when it's directed at a person or a situation. Paul said to let no corrupt communication proceed out of your mouth, but that which is good to the use of edifying, that it may minister grace unto the hearers. Paul is talking more about just foul language, though that's included. But he's talking about this contrasting speech that builds up and that corrupts, that rots, that tears down. And think about it. Again, go back to. How many times have you maybe had a problem with somebody? Let's kind of soften it a little bit. Maybe you had a problem with someone, right? And what did you do? Did you go to that person? Did you talk to them? Did you express maybe some concern? Or did you go to everybody else around and tell them, everyone else, how bad that person is? What is our speech? Again, it doesn't have to be just foul language here. Corrupt communication isn't just foul language. But maybe it's talking bad about somebody, bringing them down in front of others. Well, let's look at some examples, too, of Christ here. In Mark 3, verses 1 through 5, we see here again that Christ, when he entered the synagogue, a man was there with a withered hand, and they watched Jesus to see whether he would heal him on the Sabbath, so they might accuse him. And he said to the man with the withered hand, "Come here." And he said, "Is it lawful on the Sabbath to do good or to do harm, to save or to kill?" But they were silent. And again, it's interesting. It says, "And he looked around at them with anger, grieved at their hardness of heart, and said to the man, 'Stretch out your hand.' He stretched out, and his hand was restored." Did he lose his temper, though? Did he lose control? No. It just says he looked around with anger, and then he grieved at their hardness of heart. Jumping ahead of myself here in just a second here, but in John chapter 2, look with me in John 2. And beginning at verse 13, it says that the Passover of the Jews was at hand, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem. In the temple, he found those who were selling oxen and sheep and pigeons, and the money changers sitting there. And making a whip of cords, he drove them all out of the temple with the sheep and oxen. And he poured out the coins of their money changers, overturned their tables. And to those who sold the pigeons, "Take these things away. Do not make my Father's house a house of trade." The disciples remembered that it was written, "Zeal for your house will consume me." Now again, going back to Joseph here, we need to understand that, and we need to concentrate and think about and kind of be challenged by the fact that Joseph took the initiative in turning back anger and putting that bitterness, that wrath away. And one of the reasons that people fail to work out their problems and they become angry and become bitter is because no one's willing to take that initiative to step up and to fix it. We all want to believe that it's somebody else's fault. We always want to say it's on them and it's not me. Well, think of these examples. A husband and a wife have a fight. The husband feels like the wife is wrong and he's going to be mad, and they're not speaking until she comes and apologizes. Brethren might have an issue with one another, and both feel that the other is wrong and refuse, again, to solve the problem until the other guy takes that first step. Well, who made the rule that the other person has to take the first step? Where is that written? Christ certainly didn't say that. We can't find that in the Bible. And if you're offended, if you're the offended one, you should then go, because Matthew 18 and verse 15 tells us that, "Moreover, if your brother sins against you, go and tell him his fault between you and him alone. If he hears you, you have gained your brother." What good is the silence going to do? What good is it just to wait for that brother or sister to come to you? Or, on the flip side, if we've offended somebody else, if we've offended someone, we go to them. In Matthew 5, verses 23 and 24. "Therefore, if you bring your gift to the altar, and there remember that your brother has something against you, leave your gift there before the altar and go your way. First, be reconciled to your brother, and then come and offer your gift." If we're going to win our personal battles over angerness, over anger, over bitterness, over wrath, we must be willing to take the lead. We must be willing to work these things out. It's not just going to happen. What's going to happen, again, as we talked about in the beginning, is that it's just going to keep burning. It's going to keep stewing. It's not going to get any better. And again, consider the kindness that Joseph had. And notice that he simply didn't just forgive what they've done. He floods them with acts of kindness. He gives them food when they didn't deserve any. He protects them. And going back, Genesis chapter 15, verse 21, he says, "Therefore, do not be afraid. I will provide for you and your little ones." He comforted them, it says, and spoke kindly to them. He wasn't just forgiving them, but he provided for them. He even says multiple times that 5 more years in this famine, I'm going to take care of you. I'm going to provide this food, this shelter for you. Not just you, but your children, your little ones, your grandchildren. And notice how the Bible describes the hatred of his brothers when he was young. In Genesis, we didn't read it, but in Genesis 37, chapter 37 and verse 4, it says, "But when his brothers saw that their father loved him more than all his brothers, they hated him and could not speak peaceably to him." His heart wasn't contaminated, Joseph's heart wasn't contaminated with that envy, that hatred that was in the voice, in the tone, tone of the voice of his brothers. He spoke kindly to them when he was talking to them. He didn't remember back. He didn't say, "Remember what you guys did to me? Remember back then? Remember back when?" And his actions point, I think, to the true key to overcoming this bitterness, this anger, this wrath, rage. Again, I can go on with all the descriptive words in there. Sometimes, even after forgiveness, though, voiced tensions remain. And again, I know I spoke on forgiveness not too long ago, and I'm not going to go dwell too much further back there, but we have to be careful with that. We have to be careful that we can't just say, again, that I've forgiven someone and then treat them as an enemy. Treat them with that bitterness, with that anger, with that wrath, with that contempt. Because again, all that's going to happen is that bitterness, that anger, it's going to grow. But doing good can heal that hurt that we've had. We need to do good. Maybe someone we've had a problem with, been angered with, when they get sick, maybe we can send them a card, bring them some food. If they need some help, why can't we be the first one to volunteer? Have them over for a meal. It's not going to be easy at times, but you know what? It's the right thing to do. It's what God would have us to do. It means being a Christian. In Matthew chapter 5, verses 43 through 45 says, "You have heard that it was said, 'You shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy.' But I say to you, love your enemies. Pray for those who persecute you, so that you may be the sons of your Father who is in heaven. For he makes his sun rise on the evil and on the good. He sends rain on the just and on the unjust." In Romans chapter 12, verses 19 through 21 tells us, "Beloved, never avenge yourselves, but leave it to the wrath of God, for it is written, 'Vengeance is mine, I will repay,' says the Lord. To the contrary, if your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he is thirsty, give him something to drink. For by doing so, you will heap burning coals on his head. Do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good." Paul proclaims here that us as Christians, as God's people, we must not seek vengeance, but leave that to God. That's not our place. And his argument is that we don't have the right to seek justice on our own. We don't have that right. And he goes on to express that he would later go on that it's government here, that it's government's point to execute justice. And when the government doesn't, guess what? It's still not upon us. It's upon God. So again, I know we looked at a few different levels here, but even on a personal basis, we can't act vengeance on one another, or anyone, for that matter. And again, more than just... God calls us to repay evil with good. Just because we've been mistreated doesn't give us the right to mistreat someone else. Doesn't give us the right to talk, to gossip about someone, to bring harm upon them. Again, you know, oftentimes we think of, I guess maybe vengeance or causing harm as being something physical. That we want to cause some physical harm to someone. No, I think most of the time it happens on a emotional basis. that we want to talk bad about someone. But God tells us to repay evil with good. Our hearts must be in that right place. We have to overcome evil. It will consume us. And that's exactly what Joseph did. All of the evil that was brought into his life by Satan was undone by God through the choices that he made. And remember, Joseph had a choice right then and there when he saw his brothers. He could have acted vengeance. He was in a high position. But he overcame evil with good. You know, and again, and going back to even, I had some notes here that I added from some of the things I talked about with forgiveness. But forgive means to forget as well. We seem to have a problem with that. I think Christians have a problem with that. That forgiveness is not about hanging on to what that brother or sister did maybe to you many years ago and to using it against them. Nowhere in the Bible does it say that we're to use that and call, hey, I've forgiven you, but you did a lot of bad things to me. Oftentimes, brethren will say, I forgive, but have no intention of forgetting what was done. They're going to use that sin. They're going to try to produce guilt, produce harm, and that's not forgiveness. When God has forgiven us, he blots out what we've been repentant of. Well, again, let's continue on in just a few minutes here. But again, if we look at Joseph and we look at, I talked about perspective earlier. And we try to understand what Joseph's perspective was. And Joseph said, do not fear, for am I in the place of God? As for you, you meant evil against me. But what does he say? He says, but God meant it for good, to bring it about that many people should be kept alive as they are today. Again, as he reflects on what's happened to him, he's not dwelling on what his brothers did to him. He's not dwelling on the evil, the harm, the hurt that came to him. No. But he reflects on the good that came from it. He focuses on what God has done positively in his life. And again, that was a choice. He made that choice. He made that choice to turn into something good. You meant evil against me, but God meant it for good. Look how many people he's saying here. To bring about that many people should be kept alive. And it may be difficult at times to see God in our mistreatment, but there usually is some. At times, though, our most objective and our beneficial critics are our enemies. We need to pay attention to what they say. We can benefit from the wounds that they cause us. Has some unfair criticism, you know, made you even think upon yourself? Has some slight by others made you more careful to the care for others during a time of need? Sometimes a difficult person can help us to grow our patience. In James 1, verses 2 through 4, says, count it all joy, my brothers, when you meet the trials of various kinds. For you know that the testing of your faith produces steadfastness. And let steadfastness have its full effect, that you may be perfect and complete, lacking in nothing. Are you poisoned by anger, by bitterness, by wrath? Is it poisoning you tonight? What do you seek to do about it? Christ did not teach us to live in that way. He did not teach us to carry that anger, that resentment towards others, especially those in the household of faith. How do we look upon one another? How do we treat one another? Is it in love? Or is it in this anger, this bitterness? I guarantee you, it will destroy you. It'll destroy you physically. That stress, that emotion that you carry, and that weight you carry. But more importantly, it will destroy you spiritually. It will keep you out of heaven. If you haven't rendered obedience to the gospel, if you've heard, you believe, you repent, confess Christ, and are buried and baptized with him, you can have that eternity. It's waiting. Why wait? The question of the song is, who will follow Jesus? As a Christian, have we lost our way? Have we become angry? Have we become bitter? And maybe it's not just at one another. Maybe it's at someone outside the body. Maybe it's just at things in general. That's not the life that God would have us to live. If anyone has a need, please come forward now as we stand and as we sing.
His banner in the thickest fight.